Okay, so this morning we'll continue with this inquiry on faith, our energy, how to put forth energy, effort. And we spent the last couple of days thinking, considering the, say, views and that making an inquiry into the actual practice itself of what it entails. And today's we'll begin on the theme of making that commitment to it, that there is no effort that is able to be made unless one makes a commitment. We'll begin with a sutta reading from Majjhima 16, which is it's called the Majjhima 16. It's called the wilderness in the heart, and you know, thinking through in terms of the Buddha giving a discourse in terms of, you know, what is, you know, what is possible. And then go to the opposite. What is possible is the opposite of all the various qualities that the Buddha is talking about. Okay. Thus have I heard. On one occasion, the Blessed One was living at Savatthi in Jeta's Grove, Anathapindika's Park. There he addressed the bhikkhus thus, "Bhikkhus, Venerable Sir," they replied. The Blessed One said this, "Bhikkhus, that any bhikkhu who has not abandoned five wildernesses in the heart and not severed five shackles in the heart should come to growth, increase, and fulfillment in this Dhamma and discipline, that is impossible. What bhikkhus are the five wildernesses in the heart that he has not abandoned? Here a bhikkhu is doubtful, uncertain, undecided, and unconfident about the teacher." And that's referring to the Buddha himself. "And thus his mind does not incline to ardor, devotion, perseverance, and striving. As his mind does not incline to ardor, devotion, perseverance, and striving, that is the first wilderness in the heart that he has not abandoned. Again, a bhikkhu is doubtful, uncertain, undecided, and unconfident about the Dhamma. As his mind does not incline to ardor, and so on, this is the second wilderness in the heart that he has not abandoned. Again, a bhikkhu is doubtful, uncertain, undecided, and unconfident about the Sangha. As his mind does not incline to ardor, that is the third wilderness in the heart that he has not abandoned. Again, a bhikkhu is doubtful, uncertain, undecided, and unconfident about the training. As his mind does not incline to ardor, that is the fourth wilderness in the heart that he has not abandoned. Again, a bhikkhu is angry and displeased with his companions in the holy life, resentful and callous towards them, and thus his mind does not incline to ardor, devotion, perseverance, and striving. As his mind does not incline to ardor, devotion, perseverance, and striving, that is the fifth wilderness in the heart that he has not abandoned. These are the five wildernesses in the heart that he has not abandoned." So that's doubt about the Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha, doubt and lack of confidence about the training, and then being at odds with one's companions in the holy life. "What bhikkhus are the five shackles in the heart that he has not severed? Here a bhikkhu is not free from lust, desire, affection, thirst, fever, and craving for sensual pleasures, and thus his mind does not incline to ardor, devotion, perseverance, and striving. As his mind does not incline to ardor, devotion, perseverance, and striving, this is the first shackle in the heart that he has not severed. Again, a bhikkhu is not free from lust, desire, affection, thirst, fever, and craving for the body. As his mind does not incline to ardor, that is the second shackle in the heart that he has not severed." Take a look at the footnote. The footnote on that says body here is his own body, well, and then probably be the next one just below, is form, is sort of outer forms and things external to one. Again, a bhikkhu is not free from lust, desire, affection, thirst, fever, and craving for form. As his mind is not inclined to ardor, that is the third shackle in the heart that he has not severed. Again, a bhikkhu eats as much as he likes until his belly is full and indulges in the pleasures of sleeping, lolling, and drowsing. As his mind is not inclined to ardor, that is the fourth shackle in the heart that he has not severed. Again, a bhikkhu lives the holy life aspiring to some order of gods, thus, by this virtue or observance or asceticism or holy life, I shall become a great god or some lesser god, and thus his mind does not incline to ardor, devotion, perseverance, and striving. As his mind does not incline to ardor, devotion, perseverance, and striving, this is the fifth shackle in the heart that he has not severed. These are the five shackles in the heart that he has not severed. So that those five shackles, if not free from desire and craving for sensual pleasures, for the body, sort of worries and concerns of one's own body, form, external desire and attachment to form externally, eating as much as one likes, and indulging in the pleasures of sleeping, lolling, and drowsing, and then living the holy life looking to some future birth rather than present effort. Bhikkhus, that any bhikkhu who has not abandoned these five wildernesses in the heart and severed these five shackles in the heart should come to growth, increase, and fulfillment in this Dhamma and discipline, that is impossible. Bhikkhus, that any bhikkhu who has abandoned five wildernesses in the heart and severed five shackles in the heart should come to growth, increase, and fulfillment in this Dhamma and discipline, that is possible. So then the Buddha goes on, repeats the whole thing in terms of the other side of when one has given up those wildernesses and shackles, then that then of course that is the mind inclines to ardor, devotion, perseverance, and striving, and that's really the main theme of this whole, all these readings that are doing us. What is it that gives us the basis for putting forth effort? And so those are things to be reflected on. And then he finishes up the sutta. He develops the basis for spiritual power, consisting in concentration due to zeal and determined striving. He develops the basis for spiritual power, consisting in concentration due to energy and determined striving. Develops the basis for spiritual power, consisting in concentration due to purity of mind and determined striving. He develops the basis for spiritual power, consisting in concentration due to investigation and determined striving. And enthusiasm is the fifth. There's a footnote on that. So that's the four bases for spiritual power. The Iddhipada are, say, part of the 37 requisites of enlightenment. And they're the, say, special foundation for the five mundane kinds of direct knowledge, abhinya. And according to the commentary, enthusiasm, usorhi, is energy, which is to be applied everywhere. A bhikkhu who thus possesses the 15 factors, including enthusiasm, is capable of breaking out, capable of enlightenment, capable of attaining the supreme security from bondage. Suppose there were a hen with 8, 10, or 12 eggs, which she had covered, incubated, and nurtured properly, even though she did not wish. Oh, that my chicks might pierce their shells with the points of their claws and beaks and hatch out safely. Yet the chicks are capable of piercing their shells with the points of their claws and beaks and hatching out safely. So too, a bhikkhu who thus possesses the 15 factors, including enthusiasm, is capable of breaking out, capable of enlightenment, capable of attaining the supreme security from bondage. This is what the Blessed One said. The bhikkhus were satisfied and delighted in the Blessed One's words. So that this sutta introduces the four itipadas, the four bases for spiritual power, or also sometimes called the four bases for success. And they're what, of course, one of the requisites of enlightenment. And they're also a set of dhammas that Ajahn Mun used to refer to frequently in his teaching. It's like in reading Ajahn Mun's biography, you come across that, particularly in the Thai. I'm not sure what it's like in English, but that thing is, when coming across that, he would refer to that quite frequently. Any questions from that sutta? No. Okay. The next sutta is from the Samyutta Nikaya, Connected Discourses. This is from Samyutta 51. I haven't got that one. Samyutta 51. Sutta number 13. And this sutta kind of neatly ties together the itipadas, the basis for spiritual power, concentration, and effort. Bhikkhus, if a bhikkhu gains concentration, gains one-pointedness of mind based upon desire, so chanda in the first basis of spiritual power, this is called concentration due to desire. He generates desire for the non-arising of unarisen, evil, unwholesome states. He makes an effort, arouses energy, applies his mind, and strives. He generates desire for the abandoning of arisen, evil, unwholesome states. He makes an effort, arouses energy, applies his mind, and strives. He generates desire for the arising of unarisen, wholesome states. He makes an effort, arouses energy, applies his mind, and strives. He generates desire for the maintenance of arisen, wholesome states, for their non-decay, increase, expansion, and fulfillment by development. He makes an effort, arouses energy, applies his mind, and strives. These are called volitional formations of striving. Thus, this desire and this concentration due to desire and these volitional formations of striving, this is called the basis for spiritual power that possesses concentration due to desire and volitional formations of striving. If bhikkhus, a bhikkhu gains concentration, gains one-pointedness of mind based upon energy, this is called concentration due to energy. He generates desire for the non-arising of unarisen, evil, unwholesome states, and goes through that whole series around the non-arising of unwholesome states and the arising of wholesome states, making effort. And these are called volitional formations of striving. Thus, this energy and this concentration due to energy and these volitional formations of striving, this is called the basis for spiritual power that possesses concentration due to energy and volitional formations of striving. If bhikkhus, a bhikkhu gains concentration, gains one-pointedness of mind based upon mind, this is called concentration due to mind, or concentration due to, I'll take a look at the, when it says mind in that sense. That's the, talking about the actual peacefulness of mind, the settled quality of mind. Generates desire for the non-arising of unarisen, evil, unwholesome states, and goes through that for then, and for the maintenance of arisen, wholesome states, for their non-decay, increase, expansion, and fulfillment by development. He makes an effort, arouses energy, applies his mind, and strives. This is called the basis for spiritual power that possesses concentration due to mind and volitional formations of striving. If bhikkhus, a bhikkhu gains concentration, gains one pointedness of mind based upon investigation. This is called concentration due to investigation. Generates desire for the non-arising of evil, unwholesome states, so on through that. Thus this investigation and this concentration due to investigation and these volitional formations of striving, this is called the basis for spiritual power that possesses concentration due to investigation and volitional formations of striving. So that. Because when we talk about, say, developing concentration or developing samadhi, oftentimes it's that there's that sense of it being, just trying to focus the mind, trying to make the mind, you know, just stop somehow. But it's important in this, say, whether it's from, say, desire or zeal, or energy and effort, or the settling of the mind, tranquility of the mind, or the investigation, all of those are a basis for concentration if they're used skillfully. And particularly in this sutta, those four applications of right effort. So that I think it's really helpful to be considering that, because we sometimes get into a mode in or a model in our mind of, like, I've got to make my mind like this so I can get concentrated or get concentration or get samadhi. And, you know, there's these different ways of applying attention and applying the mind that are as valid as anything else. So it's important to have that in a perspective. Any questions? Okay. This next sutta is carried on from this one. The last one that I read, and I looked at it and I just read it for the fun of it. This is Samyutta 51, Sutta number 14, Moggallana. Thus have I heard. On one occasion, the Blessed One was dwelling at Savatthi in the eastern park, in the mansion of Megara's mother. Now, on that occasion, a number of bhikkhus who dwelt on the ground floor of the mansion were restless, puffed up, personally vain, rough-tongued, rambling in their talk, muddle-minded, without clear comprehension, unconcentrated, scatterbrained, loose in their faculties. Then the Blessed One addressed the Venerable Maha Moggallana thus, Moggallana, your brothers in the holy life, dwelling on the ground floor of the mansion of Megara's mother, are restless, so on, loose in their faculties. Go, Moggallana, stir up a sense of urgency in those bhikkhus. Yes, Venerable Sir, the Venerable Maha Moggallana replied. Then he performed a feat of spiritual power such that he made the mansion of Megara's mother shake, quake, and tremble with his toe. Then those bhikkhus, shocked and terrified, stood to one side and said, It is wonderful indeed, sir. It is amazing indeed, sir. There is no wind, and this mansion of Megara's mother has a deep base and is securely planted, immobile and unshaking. Yet it shook, quaked, and trembled. Then the Blessed One approached those bhikkhus and said to them, Why, bhikkhus, are you standing to one side, shocked and terrified? It is wonderful, Venerable Sir. It is amazing, Venerable Sir. There is no wind, and this mansion of Megara's mother has a deep base and is securely planted, immobile, unshaking. Yet it shook, it quaked, it trembled. Bhikkhus, the bhikkhu Moggallana, desiring to stir up a sense of urgency in you, made the mansion of Megara's mother shake, quake, and tremble with his toe. What do you think, bhikkhus? By having developed and cultivated what things has the bhikkhu Moggallana become so powerful and mighty? Venerable Sir, our teachings are rooted in the Blessed One, guided by the Blessed One. Take recourse in the Blessed One. It would be good if the Blessed One would clear up the meaning of this statement. Having heard it from him, the bhikkhus will remember it. Then listen, bhikkhus. It is because he has developed and cultivated the four bases for spiritual power that the bhikkhu Moggallana has become so powerful and mighty. What for? Here, bhikkhus, the bhikkhu Moggallana has developed the basis for spiritual power that possesses concentration due to desire and volitional formations of striving. He has developed the basis for spiritual power that possesses concentration due to energy, concentration due to mind, concentration due to investigation, and volitional formations of striving, thinking. Thus my investigation will be neither too slack nor too tense, and it will be neither constricted internally nor distracted externally. Thus with a mind that is open and unenveloped, he has developed the mind imbued with luminosity. It is because he has developed and cultivated these four bases for spiritual power that the Bhikkhu Moggallana has become so powerful and mighty. It is because the Bhikkhu Moggallana has developed and cultivated these four bases for spiritual power that he wields the various kinds of spiritual power. He exercises mastery with the body as far as the Brahma world. It is because the Bhikkhu Moggallana has developed and cultivated these four bases for spiritual power that by the destruction of the taints in this very life he enters and dwells in the taintless liberation of mind, liberation by wisdom, realizing it for himself with direct knowledge. That's it. I love that description of the monks dwelling in their restless, puffed up, personally vain, rough tongue, rambling in their talk, muddle-minded, without clear comprehension, unconcentrated, scatterbrained, loose in their faculties. We don't know anybody like that. Okay, the next sutta that or not sutta, this is from the Vinaya actually. And it's this is the story of Vyasa, the rich merchant's son, and he was the first layperson to come and receive teachings from the Buddha after the Buddha's enlightenment. And so I'll read the story. And the whole sort of reason for reading the story is to introduce the teaching of the Buddha as being a graduated teaching, that there is a graduated teaching and a training and introduction and a sort of building on different aspects of understanding and commitment, so that there is a reaching a point of freedom, and that whole sense of this having a successive levels of commitment and appreciation of the applications of those teachings. Okay. So, and especially sort of to introduce that as like this is from the very beginning of the Buddha's ministry. This is his insight into that, how to reach people, how to teach people, how to sort of draw them in and sort of lift them up. The occasion was this. There was a clansman named Yasa. He was a rich merchant's son and delicately brought up. He had three palaces, one for the winter, one for the summer, one for the rains. In the rains palace he was entertained by minstrels with no men among them. For the 4 months of the rains he never went down to the lower palace. Now while Yasa was amusing himself, enjoying the five kinds of sensual pleasures with which he was furnished, he fell asleep, though it was still early. And his attendants fell asleep too. But an all-light lamp was burning, and when Yasa woke up early, he saw his attendants sleeping. There was one with her lute under her arm, another with her tabor under her chin, another with her drum under her arm. The hair of one had come unfastened, another was dribbling, and others were muttering. It seemed like a charnel ground. When he saw it, when its squalor squarely struck him, he was sick at heart, and he exclaimed, "It is fearful, it is horrible." Then he put on his gold slippers and went to the door of his house, and non-human beings opened the door so that none might stop his going forth from the house life into homelessness. Then he went to the city gate, and non-human beings opened the gate so that none might stop his going forth from the house life into homelessness. He went to the deer park at Isipatana. Now the occasion was one on which the Blessed One had risen early in the night towards dawn and was pacing up and down in the open. When he saw Yasa coming in the distance, he left his walk and sat down on a seat made ready for him. When Yasa was not far from the Blessed One, he exclaimed, "It is fearful, it is horrible." Then the Blessed One said, "This is not fearful, this is not horrible. Come, Yasa, sit down. I shall teach you the Dhamma." He thought, "This is not fearful, it seems. This is not horrible." And he was happy and hopeful. He took off his gold slippers and went to where the Blessed One was. After paying homage to him, he sat down at one side. When he had done so, the Blessed One gave him progressive instruction. That is to say, talk on giving, on virtue, on the heavens. He explained the dangers, the vanity, and the defilements in sensual pleasures, and the blessings in renunciation. When he saw that Yasa's mind was ready, receptive, free from hindrance, eager and trustful, he expounded to him the teaching peculiar to the Buddhas: suffering, its origin, its cessation, and the path to its cessation. Just as a clean cloth with all marks removed would take dye evenly, so too, while Yasa sat there, the spotless, immaculate vision of the Dhamma arose in him. All that is subject to arising is subject to cessation. It's also interesting that the Buddha's out doing walking meditation in the early morning. This next discourse is number 14. It's called the Majjhima 70. It's the Kita Giri Sutta, and it's a discourse sort of on studying under the Buddha. That it required some adjusting to training, and in particular in being it's in general of training under a teacher, being under a training, and that it isn't always how we want it, and I'll begin. Thus have I heard, on one occasion the Blessed One was wandering in the Kasi country together with a large sangha of bhikkhus. There he addressed the bhikkhus thus: "Bhikkhus, I abstain from eating at night. By so doing, I am free from illness and affliction, and I enjoy health, strength, and a comfortable abiding. Come, bhikkhus, abstain from eating at night. By so doing, you too will be free from illness and affliction, and you will enjoy health, strength, and a comfortable abiding." So that's probably in the early days of the establishing of the Sangha, where the rules of training hadn't been formulated so clearly. And in the commentary, it explains that the Buddha had first prohibited the afternoon meal, and then at a later time prohibited a night meal. So he did this out of concern for the delicate bhikkhus in the order, since they might have become fatigued too quickly if both the late meals were prohibited simultaneously. Because there's that other discourse where talks about the, where is that, in the afternoon meal. The monks wandering for alms in the thick darkness of the night have walked into a cesspit, fallen into a sewer, walked into a thorn bush, fallen over a sleeping cow. They've met hoodlums who have already committed a crime, and those planning one, they have been sexually enticed by women. Once, Venerable Sir, I went wandering for alms in the thick darkness of the night. A woman washing a pot saw me by the flash of lightning and screamed out in terror, "Mercy me, a devil has come for me." I told her, "Sister, I am no devil. I am a bhikkhu walking for alms, waiting for alms." Then it's a bhikkhu whose ma's died and whose pa's died. I guess that's like somebody who lost their parents is absolutely somebody who's really destitute. "Better, bhikkhu, that you get your belly cut open with a sharp butcher's knife than this prowling for alms for your belly's sake in the thick darkness of the night. Venerable Sir, when I recollected that, I thought how painful the states how many painful states has the Blessed One rid us of? How many pleasant states has the Blessed One brought us? How many unwholesome states has the Blessed One rid us of? How many wholesome states has the Blessed One brought us?" So giving a training that gives a ease and comfort in living the holy life. Okay, so the bhikkhus now, the Buddha is now encouraged them to stop eating in the night. Okay, "Yes, Venerable Sir," they replied. "Then, as the Blessed One was wandering by stages in the Kasi country, he eventually arrived at a Kasi town called Kitagiri. There he lived in this Kasi town, Kitagiri. Now, on that occasion, the bhikkhus named Asaji and Punabasuka were residing at Kitagiri. Then a number of bhikkhus went and told them, 'Friends, the Blessed One and the Sangha bhikkhus now abstain from eating at night. By so doing, they are free from illness and affliction, and they enjoy health, strength, and a comfortable abiding. Come, friends, abstain from eating at night. By so doing, you too will be free from illness and affliction, and you will enjoy health, strength, and a comfortable abiding.' When this was said, the bhikkhus Asaji and Punabasuka told those bhikkhus, 'Friends, we eat in the evening, in the morning, and in the day, outside the proper time. By so doing, we are free from illness and affliction, and we enjoy health, strength, and a comfortable abiding. Why should we abandon a benefit visible here and now to pursue a benefit to be achieved at a future time? We shall eat in the evening, in the morning, and in the day, outside the proper time. Since the bhikkhus were unable to convince the bhikkhus Asaji and Punabasuka, they went to the Blessed One. After paying homage to him, they sat down at one side and told him all that had occurred, adding, 'Venerable Sir, since we are unable to convince the bhikkhus Asaji and Punabasuka, we have reported this matter to the Blessed One.' Then the Blessed One addressed a certain bhikkhu thus, 'Come, bhikkhu, tell the bhikkhus Asaji and Punabasuka in my name that the teacher calls them.' 'Yes, Venerable Sir,' he replied, and he went to the bhikkhus Asaji and Punabasuka and told them, 'The teacher calls you, friends.' 'Yes, friend,' they replied, and they went to the Blessed One. After paying homage to him, sat down at one side. Then the Blessed One said, 'Bhikkhus, is it true that when a number of bhikkhus went and told you, 'Friends, the Blessed One and the Sangha now abstain from eating at night,' come, friends, abstain from eating at night, you told those bhikkhus, 'Friends, we eat in the evening,' and so on, 'we're doing fine. Why should we abandon a benefit visible here now to pursue a benefit to be achieved at a future time? We shall eat in the evening, in the morning, in the day, outside the proper time.' 'Yes, Venerable Sir.' 'Bhikkhus, have you known me to teach the Dhamma in such a way as this? Whatever this person experiences, whether pleasant or painful, or neither painful nor pleasant, unwholesome states diminish in him, and wholesome states increase.' 'No, Venerable Sir.'" Yes, I'll read the... The commentary says that this statement is made with pointed reference to pleasure experienced in eating a night meal, which does not conduce to the practice of a monk's duties. Saying that... saying that you know, if one continues doing this and experiencing that, then unwholesome states will decrease and wholesome states will increase. And you say, no, that's not really the case. Bhikkhus, have you not known me to teach the Dhamma in such a way as this? Here, when someone feels a certain kind of pleasant feeling, unwholesome states increase in him and wholesome states diminish. But when someone feels another kind of pleasant feeling, unwholesome states diminish in him and wholesome states increase. So that the, in terms of, the pleasant feeling, say a pleasant feeling is joy based on the household life, on worldly, sort of worldly values, the latter is a joy based on renunciation. So that one experiences, if one is, say, bound in the world in a worldly way, then experiencing something pleasurable, then one unwholesome states increase. And wholesome states decrease, whereas that, let's say, pleasant feeling that is associated with renunciation, with skillful application of spiritual effort, then unwholesome states diminish and wholesome states increase. Here, when someone feels a certain kind of painful feeling, unwholesome states increase. And similarly, it goes through the different kinds of feeling, whether it's pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. But the point of it being that the Buddha is encouraging people to take up those practices that are based on renunciation and spiritual endeavor, rather than the following of a worldly habit. Good bhikkhus. And if it were unknown by me, unseen, unfound, unrealized, uncontacted by wisdom thus, again, he goes through those feelings, what I say, would it be fitting for me, not knowing that, to say, abandon such a kind of pleasant feeling? So you say, if I didn't really know, didn't understand, didn't have wisdom about this, and if I asked you to give it up, would it be fitting for me to say that? And they say, well, no, Venerable Sir. He says, but because it is known by me, seen, found, realized, contacted by wisdom thus, here when someone feels a certain kind of pleasant feeling, unwholesome states increase in him and wholesome states diminish, that I therefore say, abandon such a kind of pleasant feeling. And similarly, they say that when the Buddha is saying he's speaking from his own experience, from his own wisdom, his own knowledge, saying, yeah, this is what you should give up. This is what you should enter upon and abide in such a pleasant feeling, saying, because he's encouraging, saying, he's not saying, you know, you should feel miserable all the time, but saying the pleasant feelings that one should be searching or putting effort towards are those pleasant feelings that are associated with renunciation, with peace, with tranquility, with the cultivation of understanding. And so he goes through those, whether it's pleasant or unpleasant or neutral, saying to encouraging those things which are skillful to enter upon and abide in such a kind, neither painful nor pleasant feeling. Bhikkhus, I do not say of all bhikkhus that they still have work to do with diligence, nor do I say of all bhikkhus that they have no more work to do with diligence. I do not say of those bhikkhus who are arahants with taints destroyed, who have lived the holy life, done what had to be done, laid down the burden, reached the true goal, destroyed the fetters of being and are completely liberated through final knowledge, that they still have work to do with diligence. Why is that? They have done their work with diligence. They are no more capable of being negligent. So that the Buddha is saying that, yeah, there are those who are freed, who are liberated, and they have they don't have any work to do. They're not. But the thing that's interesting, though, that they're no longer capable of being negligent in the sense that just because one is enlightened is completely liberated, then one goes and that gives license to live in unskillful ways. That it just isn't how it works. It's like, it says they're no more capable of being negligent that somebody is who has freed themselves is liberated, then they're going to abide in that which is skillful and wholesome, just by nature, by the very nature of that insight and that knowledge. In the same way that the previous reading that I just did of you know, there's the Buddha fully enlightened. He's been teaching the Deer Park, trying to encourage the five disciples, bring them to liberation. And he's, I guess they're already, he's already taught them, brought them to liberation. And he gets up early in the morning, he goes out and does walking meditation, starts the day with diligence. It's like, okay, well, I'm enlightened, I've got some enlightened disciples, well, I can sleep in now and kick back and take it easy. It's just, it's not in the nature anymore. It's this skill and this wholesomeness is really embedded. And then it continues, I say of such bhikkhus who are in higher training, whose minds have not yet reached the goal, and who are still aspiring to the supreme security from bondage, that they still have work to do with diligence. Why is that? Because when those venerable ones make use of suitable resting places and associate with good friends and balance their spiritual faculties, they may, by realizing for themselves with direct knowledge here and now, enter upon and abide in that supreme goal of the holy life for the sake of which clansmen rightly go forth from the home life into homelessness. Seeing this fruit of diligence for these bhikkhus, I say that they still have work to do with diligence. Particularly this whole theme of being around effort and energy, this recollection or the recognition of the Buddha that when somebody still is not liberated, that they've still got work to do, and when they do put forth that effort and they're attentive to being in suitable places with good friends, balance their inner faculties, that they can realize the goal of the practice. So. It's also interesting that the Buddha was, as he's, so he starts teaching, obviously, in this, starting to develop the Sangha, develop the community, and he's finding, there's some things that are working, some things that aren't working, some things that's not particularly useful. Maybe we should tighten this up, make this a bit more appropriate, and so that, all this sort of eating in the afternoon, the evening, let's just sort of cut that out, keep it simple, keep ourselves easy to look after, and so that willingness of the Buddha to put forth a training, and then also to say not just acquiesce to whatever everybody thinks is comfortable or pleasing. And that was something that Ajahn Chah was in his own teaching. I mean, he was really he'd oftentimes say, I don't teach very much. I was sort of kind of just torture my disciples, and that's not just put obstacles in the way of people's habits, that's enough in that way. So that need to challenge our habits, and that was also something that he the only time that he came to America and taught at IMS, and that was in the very early days of say Jack and Joseph and Sharon starting to teach in America, and when he left, that was one of the things he told them. He said, if they need to be willing to pierce the hearts of their students, and it's not just not always try to make things comfortable for everybody, and be willing it's a tang hua giants, be able to pierce the hearts, put something forward that is a bit challenging. Questions?
Okay.